Welcome to a new series of podcasts from Infotagen, an independent fact-checking service to combat fake news about the coronavirus. This is the first major public health crisis in the age of social media disinformation, and we're here to try and make sense of it. I'm Damien Collins MP, co-founder of Infotagen and former chair of the House of Commons Select Committee for Digital Culture, Media and Sport. Today, in the special feature-length edition of our podcast, I'll be joined by our special guests, Shoshana Zuboff, professor at Harvard Business School and author of Surveillance Capitalism, and David Wooding, political editor of The Sun on Sunday, along with our resident experts, the disinformation analyst Dr. Charles Creel and John Quinlan, the CEO of Iconic Labs. Shoshana, it's fantastic to have you with us on the Infotagen podcast. I remember when we first met in London during the Select Committee's inquiry on disinformation, and we just published our initial report, and you'd commented that we'd used the terms digital gangsters in the report to refer to the big tech companies and how that had chimed with the work you'd done on surveillance capitalism. I suppose gangsters are people that demand money with menaces. And there's something in a way about the business model of the big tech companies where there is there's a lack of informed consent. It's not a very two-way street. And perhaps you could just, by way of introducing your work on surveillance capitalism, say something about that kind of disparity in power between the users of social media and the big giants in Silicon Valley.
Damien, the argument that I make is that surveillance capitalism is an economic logic. When we understand this economic logic, so many of the phenomena that puzzle us and outrage us are suddenly explicable and predictable, in very reliable ways. Surveillance capitalism, let me just state a couple of background figures. In Facebook went public in 2006. In 2007, it was valued at $15 billion. January of this year, 2020, its market capitalization was $632 billion. Google, in the year 2001, its revenues were just over $86 million. This year, in 2019, its ad revenues, which account for nearly all of Alphabet's revenues, were $113 billion. That company went from a market capitalization of $20 billion in 2004 when it went public to $1 trillion now, 16 years later. All right. So we are talking about vast empires, financial empires that were constructed in a mere 12 to 16 years. This is something unprecedented. How did this happen? My argument is it happened through stealing. Because essentially what these companies have done is to take information about our behavior, to take this information without our knowledge, and therefore obviously without our consent, to turn that information into predictions of our behavior, to sell those predictions into a new kind of marketplace that trades exclusively in these human futures. These are business-to-business marketplaces where surveillance capitalists sell these predictions to their business customers, beginning with advertisers. But now, of course, these markets have stretched far beyond online targeted advertising. So when we look at that structure, they took our behavior, They turned it into information without our awareness, and then clearly without our consent. Any 8-year-old, any 4-year-old can tell you that that is the structure of theft. These edifices of billions and now trillions of dollars are built on an original sin of theft from undefended, vulnerable, personal experience. That is the straw that they have spun into gold. And now, in their empires of information, they are the only entities on earth who have the financial, the technological, and the human resource capabilities to actually penetrate, command, analyze, understand these vast new territories of information that they created and over which they declared ownership.
One of the best known examples of the predictive power of companies like Google and Facebook was the story of that they could predict someone was pregnant before they themselves knew about it. I've seen you talk about this particular case. Given that we're all now so concerned about COVID-19, do you think that Google or Facebook could predict whether you were suffering from COVID-19 even before you've been diagnosed with it?
Yes, absolutely, if we let them. So when we talk about predictions, let me put that in a little bit of context. You know, so much about these empires is secret. And why wouldn't it be? If your empire was built on theft, you'd want to keep it pretty secret too. So we learn a lot from whistleblowers and defectors and leaked documents. In 2018, there was a leaked Facebook document that gave us insight into its artificial intelligence hub. And what we learned is that its AI ingests, that's a word from the document, a Facebook term, its AI ingests trillions of data points every day. And from those trillions of data points, it produces 6 million predictions of user behavior per second. So its predictions are actually derived from billions and billions of infinitesimal, tiny little information slivers about us, about what we do, about where we've been, about who we're with and what we're saying, information derived from our syntax, information derived from our grammar, from our photos, from our homes, from the way we walk, the stoop of our shoulders, the angle of our heads. There are billions of tiny points of what people call metadata. So this is not simply what we give them. This is what they derive from what we give them that we can have no control over because we're not even aware of what these metadata are and how they can be analyzed for highly predictive meaning. So, for example, you ask, what are good examples of prediction? These analytic capabilities have gotten to a point that for example, let's take something very simple everybody can relate to, just Facebook posts. Mm-hmm. They're not doing their analysis based on the content of what you post. They're looking at things like, do you use bullet points? Do you use exclamation marks? When you're making plans to have dinner with friends and family, do you say, I'll meet you at the corner of Main and Grand at 7:45? Or do you say, I'll meet you in town later? And even by 2008, 2009, 2010, they had established that with even these small bits of metadata, they could predict things like political affiliation, sexual orientation, and the basic dimensions of your personality on what's called the five-factor personality test, which is used all over the internet, including by, as you know, Damien, Alexander Kogan.
Yes.
When he illegitimately tapped into Facebook users' data. So that's things like, are you an extrovert or an introvert, for example? Go ahead.
Yeah. So with COVID-19, and the reason I raise that is that it's so topical at the moment because this question is being asked, and indeed apparently Google and Apple are working on it, is to say how could we use people's data trail, their mobile data and so on, to identify people with COVID-19, keep people away from places where they might get it, or alert them to the fact they may have picked it up when they were in a particular place. And there is then potentially this merging of this amazing data capability these companies have got with the capability of the state to decide where people should go, what they should do. And that's something new and in some ways quite concerning. But in some ways, what I wondered as well, I welcome your views on that, whether you're concerned about that sort of step being taken in Western societies and what the dangers are. But whilst we consider, well, could the government acquire this data? I'd be interested to know whether the companies have already got it. And actually, Google and Facebook could already take a pretty good go based on people's behavior online and taking a guess at who's had this virus and who hasn't, and therefore, who should be excluded and who shouldn't.
Well, we know from the past that, for example, even at Google, they learned several years ago that they could predict flu outbreaks, for example, from simply looking for these patterns in who was searching for Kleenex and nasal spray, and who was searching on keywords like flu symptoms. Right, so they have long known that they have the basic tools to predict patterns of disease and outbreaks, and to track outbreaks and predict outbreaks. And I don't think that there's much difference between what they've done in the past and what they are no doubt doing right now. And this is one of the points that I think it's so important for us to make for our listeners. Everyone's talking about the state of exception. Everybody's talking about crisis. From the point of view of surveillance capitalism, Damien, what's going on now is strictly business as usual. This is less of a state of exception for the surveillance capitalist firms than it is a boondoggle, a massive opportunity. And so, that AI hub that we were talking about with its trillions of data points being analyzed every day, those data are only available to Facebook because of the way it ruthlessly and relentlessly follows the economic imperatives that constrain and define its entire logic. The first one is AIs need a lot of data. So they need to be taking stuff from us at scale, huge volumes of data. The second one, and this is where we come into our COVID discussion. The second imperative they discovered is economies of scope. Not only do they need lots of data, but they need varieties of data. Every place we're going and all the things we're doing, getting us out of the house, into the city and so forth, tracking all of that, what we're saying, how we're saying it, our posture, our gait, all of that. But they also need depths of data. And this is where they became most interested in, for example, are faces and being able to read our emotions from our faces, because that's highly predictive data. They want our bodies. They have looked for ways to tap into, you know, diabetes apps and blood testing and neurological apps that give a look into brain waves. I know this sounds really kind of weird and sci-fi, and for those who are listening, I wish I could say that it was sci-fi, but this is all very well documented. And in fact, you probably know Elena Kennedy in the UK, who has been leading some of the legal conceptualization for what is now being called, you know, the privacy of the inner mental sanctum, because they have been very actively looking for ways to get access to neurological patterns and translate that into what are we thinking, and actually be able to translate brainwaves into words. So I wouldn't be making that up, folks.
Sure.
So with COVID now has instilled fear in people all around the world. And with that fear, we are often more inclined to let down our guard. And this opens the door to the new pathways into information about our bodies, where we are, who else is where we are, all those configurations of how we're moving through space and time, and who's moving with us. This, by the way, Damien, is exactly the kind of information that Sidewalk Labs, which is Alphabet/Google's subsidiary that pursues the idea of the smart city and has been trying to get a chunk of the Toronto waterfront for several years now to turn it into its Google City. This kind of data that's being proposed for the contact tracing, for example, COVID tracking, this is exactly the kind of data that Sidewalk Labs describes as part of its ambition for the data it would be collecting about people in the Google City in order to bring algorithmic governance to the city, so that you know where people are, you know what they're doing, you know who they're doing it with. And instead of having laws and community groups and neighborhood control, you simply have algorithms who are overlooking all of these behavioral flows and deciding what's okay and what has to be intervened upon and stopped.
I mean, that's a kind of a real Big Brother world, isn't it? A total surveillance there. And you said in your opening remarks that you reminded us just how fast these companies have grown. And it to me, it just underlines how the pace of public scrutiny and governance of these companies was far too slow. And there's maybe a danger now that because of a public health crisis, we give them yet more power over our lives in a way that we will never recover.
Well, Damien, this is why I always love talking to you, because you are so insightful. This is exactly where we are. And I've been trying to think of some ways that I can explain this to our listeners. The headline here is that everything we've been talking about, going back to the early 2000s, when these companies invented themselves and their rapid development and huge empire building and financial domination in just a few short years. The reason this has been able to happen is what I think of as an institutional vacuum. These empires have been built into an empty space in our societies, where there is so little awareness, so little understanding, and essentially no law to impede them. Let me try and give, if I may, an analogy. Is that all right?
Yeah, I just want to bring in David Whitting as well. He's been, I want to get his perspective on some of these things too.
It's all right. Fascinating. Yeah.
All right. Let me give my analogy and then get David, and then we can come back to what is it that we need to do now. Yeah. An analogy would be, imagine our societies, and by that I mean US society, UK society, and other Western societies, marching through the 20th century without child labor laws, without social welfare legislation, without a civil service, without statutes that oversee labor relations, without social security and other forms of safety nets, without unemployment insurance, without legislation that not only legalizes and legitimates and lends its authority to labor laws like fair wages, fair working hours, the right to bargain collectively, the right to strike, but also make sure that these laws are overseen by democratic institutions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Imagine if we were forced to walk through the 20th century naked, unprotected by these institutions that have defined our freedom and our equality and our social solidarity and the possibility of a stable, prosperous market democracy in the 20th century. Now, right? That's the situation we're in now, marching into the 21st century naked.
Absolutely. News media has been affected by this probably as much as any other industry. And at the moment, especially during the COVID crisis, we're seeing newspapers going out of print. We're seeing the collapse of advertising revenues, the massive disparity of power that exists between the big tech platforms and news organizations in particular is really reaching a crisis point. And I was wondering if you could give us your perspective on how you see that from your work at The Sun.
Yes, that's absolutely true. The outlets, the shops where people buy their newspapers are not available. More people are getting their news online. And something Shoshana was just saying there about people giving up their souls effectively to these big tech giants. What is so fascinating is that many of the people are doing this willingly. They know what's going on, and they willingly give the information up. And if you go onto Twitter, you see lots of people attacking the mainstream media, which I'm a member, while willingly being mugged by the social media giants who they now worship. So it's quite a bit of a conundrum, really. The problem is, though, now there's this widespread use of the internet for information, and lots of people are getting lies and conspiracy theories, many of them actually spread by celebrities who like to attack newspapers because we write things about them they don't like, but they are in turn spreading lies on the internet, but of course it's not regulated in the way we are. So really, you need the trust of the broadcast media, radio, TV, and the old established newspapers, which are regulated. I think Shoshana used the phrase surveillance gangsters. Was that right? It's more like a Wild West, I would say, out there, where everybody runs amok and does what they like and says what they like. And the problem is, I don't know how the media giants keep saying that they're going to manage it better, but it's not, they're just hosting the platform, unlike a newspaper, which is a publisher. They present themselves as providing a platform to ordinary people, and what in fact it's similar to is us publishing letters from our readers which are not true, or which spread misinformation. We monitor all those letters on the social media. People are allowed to just put things up, and within a few clicks, hundreds of thousands, millions of people have seen them. And if they try to regulate this, a lot of it is done by algorithm. So by time the algorithms work, it's been shared by millions of people. If it's removed, then they can re-edit it and post it again. And if labels are stuck on them saying this is unreliable, that only serves to amplify the conspiracy theory or the misinformation. And as in the blink of an eye, a lie or a bit of fake news can be twice around the world and millions of people are sharing it.
Absolutely. But of course, one of the big differences between, say, your paper and Facebook is that your editor is legally responsible for the letters and the adverts, as well as what the journalists write. And there's no such responsibility for the big companies. Mark Zuckerberg ultimately has no real legal liability for what people do on Facebook, even though that's where he makes his money.
No, and they keep telling us they're going to do something about it. And they are millions and millions times more powerful than the mainstream media is. And as you rightly say, at the moment, this is a real threat because weeks and weeks of lockdown, the lack of advertising. I was looking through one of the national newspapers the other day, and I think I got to about page 24 before I saw the first advert. So, of course, with all the shops being closed, nobody is advertising because they've got nothing to sell. Which is having an impact on newspapers. The sales are struggling already, competing with the internet. The sales are struggling. And strange enough, people who go out spending £2.50 on a posh coffee in one of these shops doesn't want to spend 50p on a newspaper because they think they can get it all for free on the internet. And of course, the stuff you're reading on the internet for free, you get what you pay for. And often the stuff you get there, it's not done by professional journalists who can weed through stuff. I had one the other day, incidentally, sent to me an email by an intelligent, professional man I know, not a journalist, works in London. And he said, have you seen this? Is this true? And he'd shared it with a number of people and via email, probably WhatsApp, I guess. And it was of riots in Paris. And they're rioting over all this. Why are them and the media are hushing it up? It said the media won't print it because the government have gagged them. So I immediately replied, "Well, the government are not. No government in a Western society is allowed to gag a newspaper or a TV broadcaster. And in fact, the newspapers wouldn't hush it up themselves willingly anyway. But just to be double sure, I sent it to an old colleague of mine I know who works in Paris. So can you just check this out? What is this?" And he looked at the video and he said, "Oh yeah, that's about 5 years ago. It's it was the student riots. So there's a little flag in the corner on 35 seconds if you check that out." So I wrote back to them and they were quite gobsmacked that this had been circulating all over social media. The big one, Damien, that you may have been a victim of a few times is the old one that circulates on Facebook about MPs' pay. There's two pictures, one of an empty House of Commons chamber.
I don't know what you mean, yeah.
And one of a packed House of Commons chamber. The empty House of Commons chamber, it says, this is MPs voting on giving aid to Syria or some other such worthy subject. And there's about half a dozen or a couple of dozen MPs in the chamber. Then there's a crowded one with MPs standing at the back. It said, this is MPs voting on giving themselves a pay rise. Well, as we all know, MPs don't vote on giving themselves a pay rise and haven't done for many, many years. It's now done by an independent panel. And secondly, that picture was taken at PMQs. It's always packed every week for Prime Minister's questions. And the other picture was probably taken at any other stage of some kind of run-of-the-mill backbench bill with not many people in the Commons. And yet these things keep circulating around. And whenever I challenge that, when I see it, not being an MP myself, but wanting to put people right, they always say, "Oh yeah, no, you're just saying that because your mates are MPs." You see, and people, the willingness of people to believe some of these lies is quite astounding sometimes.
But the danger is that if there are no rules of the road, and then it's whoever shouts the loudest, you know, gets the most attention, and no one has any responsibility, and this information can circulate unchallenged. And we've been used to talking about that in the past in the political context, but of course now we're seeing it in the middle of a public health emergency when some of this disinformation could kill people by giving them false facts about cures and remedies that they could take to protect themselves.
Yes, and Shoshana was saying earlier about how this the internet could be used to predict outbreaks. Well, where was it doing something good there? All it seems to be doing since the outbreak is doing something bad. I mean, the rumours that have been flying around about the 5G masks was the classic one, where people have actually in Birmingham and in Merseyside have been setting fire to these masks because of a false rumour. Again, some of these have been spread by celebrities and shared on social media that these 5G masks weaken our immune system and somehow contribute to the spread of the virus. Absolute nonsense. Any journalist checking this out would know it's nonsense. We don't report this because it's not true. And by reporting the false rumour, you're just as bad as the people who are spreading it in the first place. But I raised it at a press conference recently with the number 10 press conference, and it was Michael Gove and the chief scientific officer were both saying, yes, these are very, very dangerous. Not only they are rubbish, it's dangerous rubbish. I mean, other rumours we've come across are things about drinking water can protect against it. Again, people might be doing this thinking they're doing themselves some good, or that military helicopters are going to spray disinfectant over housing estates and there's going to be curfews, or that there's going to be military rule, martial law imposed, all sorts of scary rumours. And people are at a vulnerable time and are willing to believe this. Being a journalist, I often get messages from WhatsApp on emails and text messages from friends who are not journalists saying, is this right? And sometimes it's a rumor you've heard on the internet several times before, and sometimes it isn't. But invariably, it's wrong. And people get scared at a time when everybody's feeling a little bit vulnerable.
It's been a fascinating discussion so far. But we have people who have heard the Infotainment podcast before will be familiar with the voices of Charles Creel and John Quinlan. Charles, former special advisor to the Select Committee when I was chairman, and sort of expert analyst on disinformation, and John Quinlan from Iconic Labs, our sort of technology partners and co-founders of Infotagen. I just would like to sort of bring Charles and John into the discussion if I can, and asking them in particular if there's anything they want to follow up on what we've heard from Shoshana or from David.
Well, thanks, Damien. You know, I was very interested in what Shoshana was having to say about the way that these companies operate and the kind of data that's being collected, and something you were saying earlier as well, Damien, about using this data to keep people away from places where people might actually get coronavirus. I mean, I immediately look at that and see the creation of coronavirus ghettos and no-go zones that people will be afraid to go to. Just today, the French digital minister has advocated that Google and Apple should lessen their privacy rules and give more information to governments to help them to track coronavirus. And the difficulty of that is really incredible. I mean, imagine an area that's high in coronavirus, and you have data companies that currently are doing things like Cambridge Analytica data is being used by a company called Glue to predict pockets of depression, grief, and addiction at the moment. And this is to help expansionist churches with some of their models. Imagine if that kind of prediction is able to be used by governments or a more malevolent force. It's quite a frightening proposition. And then there's a second side to that, that if you have a very aggressive surveillance capitalism model that is operating, that is how this data has been taken, that is how it's been, that shapes how it's been examined by artificial intelligence, then almost anybody using that data, whatever their original purpose might be, will end up finding themselves in a framework of aggressive surveillance capitalism. And the implications of that are quite stunning.
Absolutely right. Yeah, absolutely. John, what do you, Interested in your thoughts on the. I mean, you work as like, you know, with Iconic Labs. This is the world in which you've built your business. And
yeah, it's interesting. And I'm listening in, and I'm thinking, I'm in a very strange position here actually, because I look at something like the growth of Facebook. So you know, my previous company, Unilad, we actually, you know, we used Facebook's algorithms to our advantage better than anyone else. And that's where we went from nothing to building a kind of company very quickly. And, you know, just to give an idea, and I completely agree, by the way, about the Wild West analogy, because you had us who were just an organization growing all the time and finding our feet, but we were reaching 1 billion people a week on Facebook. So it was crazy. Now, but I do look at it, and I look at the kind of the stuff we're doing now with Infotagen. And I've got businesses now that have published content on Facebook as well, like everyone does. I think that's maybe part of the issue. But I look at the cold hard facts of it, and I'm interested to see what the other guests think. But we're all driven by an advertising model at the end of the day. In my other businesses, and I think some of the fake news that we see around Infotagen as well is driven by media companies, some of them, but a lot of platforms who don't have a huge incentive to crack down on content being produced on their platforms because everyone's getting paid from it, indirectly through advertising. And when you've got an advertising model that is based around cost per thousand views, or cost per impressions, or in, you know, Google's case, you've got a situation there where it's, you know, maybe a cost per action on people clicking through to a search result. I mean, isn't that in some respects like what you were saying, Shoshana, at the start, where you mentioned immediately their revenue numbers, like, and how much of it comes from advertising? I mean, really, isn't that kind of a bit of a problem at the heart of all of this, as well as the platforms themselves?
But we're all just, you know, part of the big advertising puzzle.
Yeah.
I mean, Damien, could I weigh in on that for a moment? Because, you know, I think it's so important for people to understand. When we're listening to these, David's descriptions, for example, I mean, it's so dire, and it feels so overwhelming, and it just feels like there's so much toothpaste out of the tube. How can we ever fix this? I want to counter that feeling, because now, to pick up on John's observations, everything that we're talking about is driven by a very clear and rather simple economic logic. And as we have come to learn more and more, especially because of your work, Damien, on the investigations into Cambridge Analytica, we've come to learn more and more that not only is this huge machinery of disinformation driven by financial incentives, but it is also related to political incentives. Financial incentives and political incentives can be, and indeed going back to my 20th century analogy, must be interrupted and outlawed by law, by the rule of law, by legislation, by democratic oversight. That is our work now. For example, we know from another leaked memo, Facebook, 2018, this is a guy named Andy Bosworth, one of the top execs at Facebook, right-hand guy to Mark Zuckerberg for many years. A memo he wrote to his department talking about connection. He said, we connect no matter what. Sometimes people use connection for a good thing. They meet and fall in love, get married. Sometimes they use it for a bad thing. They use connection to create a terrorist plot and they kill people. Whatever it is, he says, we connect. We connect, we connect. It is always the right thing for us to do because this is how we achieve economic growth. Boom. Hiding in plain sight. This is money in the bank for these guys. That's how these huge numbers have been achieved. We can easily see how to interrupt the financial incentives that drive disinformation. That's number one. Now, we have learned so much since Cambridge Analytica about not only the economics, but the political economics of disinformation. Some of you may already be aware of Steve Levine's new book, where he goes and does a deep dive into Facebook, as he did quite a few years ago into Google, which was a book that I found very useful when I was doing my work. Let's talk about Steve Levine's account of July 2018. So what is this, about 6 months, Damien, after your parliamentary investigations of Cambridge Analytica?
Less than that, yeah, 3 or 4 months, yeah.
Okay, July 2018. And he's talking about the Facebook senior executives agreed that they needed to rewire the algorithms and the news feed in order to give serious publishers a leg up. But others in the group, other executives pushed back, especially Joel Kaplan, who was a former chief of staff to George W. Bush and had become Facebook's vice president of global public policy. And his argument was, if we give mainstream serious publishers a leg up, as we should for the sake of truth, as David told us, well, then the consequence of that is we're going to get into trouble with Washington, because they're going to say we're supporting liberals, because we live in a country now where Washington is dominated by conservatives and they want Breitbart News and they want the Daily Caller, and we can't afford to get into their bad books. So Zuckerberg, who is the king, Zuckerberg, we, unsuspecting democratic citizens in our democracies, we made Zuckerberg the king of social connection on planet Earth by not having laws. Zuckerberg, who is the king, is listening to these debates. And according to Steve Levine's account, at the end of the climactic meeting on that July 9th, Zuckerberg sided with Kaplan and announced that he was tabling the decision about adding ways to boost publishers, effectively killing the plant. This stuff, this scourge of disinformation that David is talking about, and the undermining of legitimate journalism, which has the fiduciary, moral, and institutional responsibility to print the truth. This disinformation has been created by people. It was created by people in the absence of law, and it can be uncreated by people. There are political arts and sciences involved here, but ultimately, this is not rocket science. This is what we did in the 20th century to curb the excesses of titanic, tyrannical industrial capitalism, and we can do it now.
I think your story as well about that particular decision of Mark Zuckerberg also shows that we're often told by the companies that they can't do things because they don't have the legal power to do it, or the Constitution protects people's rights or free speech in particular, so they can't act, or they don't have the technical capability. But actually, when you see and hear more of these examples, you realize it's just because they don't want to. It's not because they can't. It's because they don't want to, because it doesn't suit their business model to do so.
Correct. Absolutely correct. And how our fellow citizens can learn to distinguish this perpetual drumbeat of gaslighting, you know, from actual truth. You know, that's part of the work that we've all been doing. We've been doing it for the for the past few years, and we're doing it today, and we're going to continue to do it, because the outcome of this crisis that Charles and John are talking about, the potential expansion of these surveillance empires and their further integration into the state, and now we're creating these tyrannies of massive information and power asymmetries that literally take us so far afield from the possibilities of a democratic society. It really, you know, that's when it really does become a crisis. We can say to people, this is something that this is something that we can move together collectively, public opinion, public education, lawmakers moving together collectively. None of the outcomes of this crisis are determined. You've got scholars and journalists and all kinds of people writing essays saying, this is going to be the world after COVID-19. COVID-19 is going to be COVID-1984. I say to that, absolute rubbish. No one knows what the world will be after COVID-19, because it depends upon our reaction. If we had stood on the shoulders of the very end of the 19th century and looked forward into the 20th, we would have anticipated a century of oligarchs and serfs, monopolists and their slave labor. That's what it would have looked like from the end of the 19th century, certainly in the United States. But that is not what we got in the 20th century, because there's a dialectic, and society came back and said, we're going to take all of this, we're going to tether it to society, we're going to put it under democratic control, and that's how we stand true with equality, dignity of the individual, and the aspirations of a market democracy.
Well, that's I appreciate that we've run a lot longer than I thought we were going to do, but it's been such a fascinating discussion, and that was such a powerful place probably to finish. But before we do, I just want to ask if there are any other points that people wanted to make that haven't yet made that we can cover off now, or otherwise we'll end the recording right about there.
I've just got one little point. Yeah. Don't know whether you found it relevant, but on the business of COVID, there was an Ipsos Mori poll which found that 65% of people agreed with using their phones to identify those who've been diagnosed, so they can work out who they've been in contact with. So, you know, if you want to call it Snooper's Charter, Big Brother, or whatever, there is a bit of public support for giving up some of your, I don't know whether it's privacy, but to be intruded upon by the state, to be snooped on, in fact, if it is for their own good. And that's a bit of a paradox, really, because we all hate the Big Brother state, but with COVID-19 coming in, there's an element of feeling that some people are quite happy to give up more of their freedoms and to be looked at by the government, by the state, not by the big tech giants, simply because they feel it will protect them.
Well, it's a really interesting point, because I mean, people might agree to that during a crisis, but then once you've opened the door to that, can you ever close it again, or would only be
exactly different? That's the big point. Yeah. because I mean, this could in turn lead to identity cards, or the government have said there'd be safeguards on that, but once that door is open, as you rightly say, if we use it for the pandemic, will it be rolled out more frequently? And it's almost like crossing a Rubicon, isn't it, David?
And I think I also think people might be very willing to have other people who have COVID identified, but they might not be so quick to be identified mm-hmm. themselves.
Yeah, because I imagine I welcome your views on this, that you could design the system in such a way that you could get a text from the health service saying, you may have been in contact with someone with COVID-19, but presumably you wouldn't necessarily have to, all the health service needs to know is whether that proximity took place. It doesn't need to know where it happened necessarily. And I think if people thought they could be alerted to potential health risks, that's one thing. But the idea of them giving their consent to the government tracking everywhere they go, I think is a very different thing, and probably not even necessary in order to help warn people if their health is at risk.
But I also think it's so important for us to remember that kind of survey result, you know, that's like looking at somebody who's soaking wet and not understanding that they're standing out in a downpour without an umbrella. What's happened, certainly in the UK and in the US, and to a certain extent in some of the other countries, but much less so in others, what's happened in our two countries is a failure of the central government, a failure of our federal governments to anticipate and protect us from this pandemic. And we know very specifically that our two countries are some of the most surveyed countries, the most surveyed societies on earth. And despite all the data that our leaders had, they decided to ignore and suppress the data in favor of their own short-term political objectives. And so when you're an individual living in a society where the government has failed, and the hospitals are overwhelmed, and there's no testing, and all of the kinds of public health infrastructure that should be there is vaporized. Well, then fear takes over. And in that fear, then you look to, you know, whatever entity out there seems to have its act together, seems to have, you know, some semblance of knowing what it's doing. And you become much more vulnerable to this kind of technology solution, ungovernable technology solution, than you would if you lived in a society where there had been the orderly, painstaking preparation and protection for citizens in this very, very treacherous and scary time. So I think we've got to understand these numbers, put them in their context, and understand that they are fear-driven. And a lot of that fear has been unnecessary because of the complete failure of our central governments.
Absolutely. And as I said at the beginning, I think it's things have moved so fast that regulators have struggled to keep pace and maintain their understanding of what's actually been happening. And I think the last couple of years, we've started to become more familiar of understanding those issues and what are the right questions we should be asking and the right measures to put in place. And I agree with you that we've got to ultimately remind ourselves in a democratic societies, it's the parliamentary institutions and the governments elected by the people that ultimately have the final say, not companies, no matter how big they might be.
Bravo.
Wonderful. In that case, I think we will draw a line there, although we could carry on probably for the rest of the evening. Shoshana, thank you so much for joining us all the way from Maine.
Thank you, Damien. It's an honor.
And David, great to have you with us as well. And yep. Charles and John, thank you again. And until next time, we're on the podcast. But David, Shoshana, thanks so much for being with us.
Cheers, all. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Infotagent podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins MP, featuring Shoshana Zuboff, David Wooding, John Quinlan, and Dr. Charles Creel. It was produced by Lucy and David Dagahi. You can find out more about Infotagent and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagent.com, or following us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you. Until next time.